You are listening to Uncanny Landscapes, Excursions into the Otherwise, with Justin Hopper.
I think that idea of symbiosis that I maybe mentioned earlier is really, really important right now and has been really important in this project. Trying to accept the impact of one thing upon the other, that this you cannot get away from the cultural and political shaping of the place you're in. And you can try and convince yourself of the romance of it, but you can never experience it through anything apart from your human body, and you can never experience it through anything apart from the cultural and political and environmental impacts of humanity on it. And that could be seen as bleak, but it's also a truth. The creative approach that Tom and I were striving towards is looking towards how do we work in more of a symbiotic way.
Welcome to Uncanny Landscapes, a series of conversations around and excursions into landscapes of the otherwise. Each episode features an interview with a landscape practitioner, someone whose work is rooted in the strange ways we today experience our surroundings. I am your host, Justin Hopper, and you've just heard one of today's guests, Kirsty Badenoch, talking about an artistic process inspired by lichen and other symbiotic relationships, which led to she and writer Tom Jeffrey's new collaborative exhibition. More from Kirsty and Tom very soon. The music you hear is Unnamed Unseen from the new album Memory Islands by Ellie Wilson, available through the Bigo and Twigetti record label. Subscribe to Uncanny Landscapes on Substack. It's free and includes the podcast as well as my occasional newsletters of related topics and works in progress. And if you like this work, like and subscribe and tell a friend, maybe a few. Falling, Fallen, Felled is an exhibition and artist's book exploring overlapping languages of forests created by artist Kirsty Badenoch and writer Tom Jeffries. In the early spring, the two spent time in two sites of remnant ancient woodland in Scotland, Abernathy Forest in the Cairngorms and Benaig on the country's northwestern coast, where they explored the landscape and made new work. That new work is now to be shown in an exhibition on in London from the 9th to the 12th of November at Staffordshire Street Gallery in Peckham, South London. For full details and links, see the podcast's webpage. The exhibition will show again in Edinburgh, Scotland in February of 2024. As Jeffries has written of the project, the majority of the works were produced near Benaig. There, Kirsty eschewed the celebrated landscapes of the nature reserve to set up an improvised studio, without permission, in a small privately owned forestry plantation. Working on large paper skins across the forest floor, she made use of a range of tools and materials, including branches, mosses, inks, and artificial fertilizer. In a process designed to foreground the relinquishment of control, the drawings were left out, often overnight, to be subjected to chance processes of non-human agency, rain, gravity, and the occasional hungry slug. In this process, these collaborators rethought what it means to say one is working the land, and examined an ancient forest biome in a remote part of the UK that nonetheless cannot escape the touch and the language of humankind. Kirsty Badenoch is an artist, architect, landscape architect, and researcher based in London whose work engages with fragile and disturbed landscapes, territories, communities, and ecologies. Tom Jeffries is a Scotland-based writer whose books and articles look at art, landscape, and ecology. And here he is, describing the artistic outcomes of weeks spent in the old-growth forest biomes of northern Scotland.
I guess there's two main outcomes. It's like a gallery exhibition and the artist book. In terms of the exhibition, it's like, I mean, it's a series of works that Kirsty made in the kind of forest studio up in northwest Scotland, near a place called Benaig, which is the first state-owned and managed nature reserve in the UK. And that's, yeah, on a kind of big dramatic Scottish Highland mountain with a loch kind of nearby. And we were there March?
Yeah, March, April, yeah.
This year.
Hmm.
Yeah, so like the exhibition is primarily a series of like drawings,
mm-hmm.
The majority of which were produced like on site in a bit of like private commercial forestry plantation, just by like that only road, pretty much, which we worked in for kind of about a week. Mm. And then there's also a body of work that was produced slightly differently in a kind of slightly more, I guess, more obviously collaborative way.
Yeah.
And
it's, yeah, so it's the first time these pieces have been tested in an urban environment, I guess, because we were incredibly immersed in the middle of nowhere for a very long time. And it was very much about sort of connecting to that place and responding to it and allowing the place to shape these pieces and our processes. And so it was very, the things that we made were very of the forest. And so this is the first time we've kind of brought them into the city and understand, and that's kind of what this exhibition about is about as well, understanding what that means in this urban context.
Can you take a moment, Kirsty, and describe to us one or two pieces that we will see walking into the gallery? And then maybe we can work with those one or two pieces and figure out the process that goes into that and maybe learn a little bit about that alchemical reaction of the artworks into, you know, placed into an urban environment, like you said.
Yeah. So the pieces that are showing, they're quite big. They're so I work very much with my body and the physical relationship between self and person and the space that you're in, so the environment. And so the pieces are all as big as I am. they're sort of my arm span length, and then the same upwards. And so there's something in that about the scale of the human compared to the scale of the space that you're occupying, or the scale of the forest. And they are ink pieces, and the sort of series developed quite organically, but they have gone through quite a lot of steps and processes. So sorry, that sounds very abstract. But how would you describe them?
I guess
I'm very in it.
Yeah, okay. They're pretty much around about 2 meters across each piece, I guess, is that right?
Mm.
Mostly made using like blue ink and like in dark blue ink and Miracle-Gro, which has quite a like acidic blue kind of fertilizer feel, which is, yeah, maybe we can talk about that later because this is quite a weird material to use.
Mm.
Yeah, and they were made, yeah, and the majority of them were made in this like temporary forest studio. So it's like a series of gestures that create marks across the paper, and Kirsty mostly works on the ground horizontal. So the paper is like spread across the ground, the kind of mossy, like undulating, not especially level ground of the forest, and making these kind of like quite large, like, yeah, gestures. So that the ink kind of, you can trace the gestures through the marks.
And they're very much process drawings. I guess that sounds very cliche, but it's, I think that the element of time is really important in them, and they, we would work for a day or a morning in the forest, kind of drawing and painting, and then would leave the pieces there over 24 hours and then come back, and then things would have happened, like a slug has sort of eaten the corner of one, and the rain has dissolved a load of the paint or the ink. It's sort of allowing a space for the topography to make itself, and then I would come in again and respond to that, and so intervene, and then would leave it again for another day. And so the process was quite emotional. Like sometimes you'd come back and the whole thing had dissolved because there'd been this huge rainstorm in the middle of the night. But something of the day before would still just about be visible. And then the next day's worth of activities would happen. So some of them are quite worked up or quite deep, and some of them work as much with erasure as they do with mark making.
Tell me about this place that you've been to and how you work together within this location in order to make these works come into being.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of answers to that question, I guess. And maybe it's easiest to just go with what we did in like roughly order. So we spent the first period of time in another location, Abernethy Forest in the Cairngorms, which is another like remnant sort of ancient woodland. And I think what was important about being there, it was obviously the site itself, but it was also like beginning to get a sense of what a collaboration between us might look like in terms of, yeah, exactly as you say, like I'm a writer, I write in a relatively like conventional, traditional format, like words in books on the computer screen printed out. And Kirsty is an artist and architect and works like, with like materials. So trying to think through how those practices meet and if they do. And I think like the first thing we did was go into the woods and walk incredibly slowly, and like not really make or do anything. And I think like, which was like Kirsty's a kind of initiated that as a kind of introductory exercise, I guess.
Mm.
And I think like going
by
to
slow, he means really
like as slow as you can possibly
slower than a human heartbeat. It was which is a weirdly difficult thing to do as well. And so I think somehow even the incredibly simple act of just slowing everything down in yourself opened you up to a different way of being in the landscape and receiving it, and also kind of being together as well.
I think there was like, I guess maybe two aspects to the collaboration, or there's more than that, but like it can probably be divided into like one was like, which we can get to in a minute, was like a quite clear attempt to make a work that grew out of something that we did together. And then there was this more like doing our thing together in a place.
Tom and I have known each other technically for 5 years or more.
Yeah,
six maybe.
Yeah, okay.
But the amount of time we've actually spent together is probably like 5 hours. until that trip. And so we connected initially over a really mutual interest in the topic, in working with ecology, in working with forests, in understanding the landscape through, reading, writing, drawing, walking. Just, I guess that was the sort of spark of connection, but work with very different practices, and were brought together by those themes, but didn't necessarily know how each other worked or who each other were. So there was a lot of trust in that, and a lot of kind of intrigue in let's go to this place and bring our own perspectives and our own natural ways of working, or our own industry norms in a very cold way, and understand how we can dissolve those boundaries or connect them in new ways. And for me, that links to quite an ecological way of thinking. It's sort of saying, okay, we're not these isolated, I don't know, that our practices and our modes of working can learn from each other, and the most fruitful exploration of something new can happen when they join or when they merge or when they connect. So I guess there was some desire to be like lichen, to sort of, lichen is a, it's a living organism, but it's the symbiosis. It only exists in the symbiosis between moss and algae. Is that right? Yeah.
I'm going to nod, but I don't actually know.
And so there was something really, I don't know, we were really interested in exploring that fertile ground between different ways of working and different kind of beings in an ecological environment. So we really wanted to bring ourselves in and everything we knew, and also open ourselves up to completely new forms of interacting.
So the two things that I went into this wanting to test, and one was like, yeah, where a writing practice meets a drawing practice, and like what they say to each other and what the differences are between those things, and like, yeah, at what point writing becomes drawing, or do they hold a difference apart that they don't really merge together, or maybe the merging is not that useful. And then the other thing was like, for a separate project, I was reading Rebecca Solnit's Orwell's Roses book, and in that she talks like quite interestingly about, and it's quite a hard difference that she draws between writing as this like disembodied, abstract kind of practice that is like takes place in Orwell's case, I guess, on a typewriter, but then on a computer screen, and like books being quite disconnected from the subject they're talking about. And she contrasts that with his interest in gardening and her own interest in gardening, which is like dirty material, hands in the soil. And she's like, these two things don't meet. Writing is over here and up here, and gardening is like over there and, you know, bodily. And I guess I was interested in going like, could we test ways? And there's lots of other people who have, but how could I personally test ways collaboratively where like those things meet, like writing is material and embodied? And does that like, do I have anything to contribute to that? And like, how would that look between us? There was a particular day that I think was like super hard in terms of trying to make a collaboration work. And I think it was a day where we kind of really, both of us like demonstrated a commitment to a project that was difficult. And for me, normally I would be like, this is hard, I'm going to retreat. But it was like, here is another person who is finding this difficult and is not retreating. So like, you owe it to this other person to also like do your best, I guess.
At the beginning, we had lots of different experiments that we were doing that were quite fun, because at the beginning of the process, there's nothing to lose and you're going out with a curiosity and kind of playfulness. And then suddenly you find that you've been living in the forest for a few days. You've got loads of pieces of paper with things on them, and you've got loads of photographs, and you've got loads of memories, and you've had loads of conversation, and you're faced with this kind of chaos of stuff. And there's a feeling of trying to make sense of that and trying to progress it. And we felt at that point there was a load of Tom's stuff in his world and a load of my stuff in my world, and how do they meet? And so we just started sometimes just kind of simple, perhaps stupid things, where one of us, like Tom, would read a piece that he'd written during a walk, and I would draw the sound of his voice as it was walking. And there were kind of a few different translations we were doing of one another's work. And I think for me, I'm kind of maybe a bit used to sending in a sort of madness where you're really not sure where you're going, and you know you have to persevere through it, and you kind of just have to accept that you've got no idea where you're going. And just as an aside, that happened both creatively and physically. We got lost in this forest many times. We were traveling with OS maps that sometimes misled us, or we got lost or couldn't. There were no markers in the landscape we were navigating to help us understand where we were. I'd say that happened also creatively. You have to succumb to being very vulnerable to the environment, to just saying, okay, we're just going to carry on walking what seems like west, because I think it's afternoon and the sun's setting over there, and let's just keep on doing that. And in the same way, this day, I guess, I just relent. I wouldn't let us leave the house, because it felt like we had all these pieces of stuff, and we kind of needed to face it or test how they link or translate between one another. Or, I don't know, do we take a drawing that I just did, and does Tom write that? How does that make sense? The 3 hours that we walked slowly, one foot in front of the other, can we record that somehow through mapping or through a drawing? And so it was kind of, you know, from the outside, maybe a bit mad. Or but yeah.
I mean, one specific there was like, so in trying to think about like the material form of the writing, and as someone, yeah. So one thing we wrote, Kirsty had made these like super cool like fold out sketchbook type objects that like fold out to about the same size as the drawings, right? Width-wise. So like 2 meters, like pretty slim, 2 meters across. So I was like, I'm going to write a text that fits this object, i.e. every single line is like 2 meters of writing and then back and 2 meters and 2 meters. And I think I ended up like not having any punctuation at all, but maybe there was some, but it was pretty much like write some kind of story narrative that tries to evoke some of what we've been doing, which is basically like walking around lost, as Kirsty said, but that is more about the form that the writing sits upon rather than like the words as such.
Yeah.
And as someone who's like mostly writing for like magazines or books, the form is quite constrained for you, and like all of that has been decided already and agreed upon.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this, and then what my role is to like write good words. Whereas this was like, it actually doesn't matter what words are in a way. It's like, just fill this page. So that, and it was quite interesting to then have to share something that I was like, I have not read this 20 times. I've not edited it. No way I'd want to see this out in the world ever, but I'm going to give it to you and you're going to do something with it, or we're going to talk about it. And that's quite like risky, or it feels risky, or it's kind of unnerving. And I guess, like you mentioned trust earlier, and it feels like quite a trusting thing to sort of give that to somebody. And then I suppose like with that, Kirsty then responded to the forms of the writing through a kind of map, through making that text into a map.
Yeah.
So, and yeah.
Yeah. And it was quite interesting allowing the pieces to accumulate over time as well, because that feels important in the forest. I mean, the lure of the forest is in its complexity and in the amount of sort of particularly the old growth forest, which is the most ancient forest on the planet, and that was where we were. So to have this sort of 230 million year old accumulation of stuff and complexities and interactions having built up, and we only had 2 weeks, but could we start to also work in a similar way? Could we start to embrace these complexities to sew bits of our pieces together and allow new forms, and maybe some of them die off early, but other ones sort of, I don't know, yeah, turn into something.
Can the two of you together tell me a bit about that location, both as a sort of, you know, as a place that's on the map and that people might visit, but also as you experienced it through these methods, such as walking extraordinarily slowly, you know, because it feels to me like there's a oh, well, I'll tell you that stuff later. Could you start by just describing this place, both the way a Wikipedia page might and the way, you know, someone who's actually seen it and been there? I don't mean describe it like a Wikipedia page. I mean, like, it's the oldest on the planet. What does that actually literally mean? That kind of thing.
Yes, absolutely.
And where it is, because I don't know.
Okay, so the terrain that we're working with is the boreal forest. It's the largest land biome. It's the largest land biome on Earth. The second largest biome on the planet after the ocean. It runs around the whole of the northern hemisphere. So it connects Russia, Finland, Norway, the top of Iceland, little pieces left of it in Scotland, where we were, all the way around Canada. And so it's a vast piece of the planet, and it's one connected biome. So it was formed from the retreat of the glacier in the ice age 230 million years ago. And so it's old and it's big. And so I think the idea of scale was really interesting for us, how you can have one connective organism that runs around the whole of the planet. It's quite mad. And so Tom, his book, The White Birch, trod the forests of Russia. And so he spent a number of years looking into the relationship between Russian culture and the boreal forest, or taiga, as it's known in Russia. And then last year, I was in Canada, also exploring the Canadian counterpart. So both of us have this history of treading these places and kind of getting under the skin of this kind of amazing ancient forest. So when we started this project together, we were looking at Scotland. Tom lives in Edinburgh, so it's relatively local to him. And I also have Scottish heritage, so there's something kind of personal in that. So unfortunately, the fragments of forest that remain in Scotland are few and very disconnected. So I think there's, what is it? Is it 49 or 23?
There's like some dispute over how many patches there are left, depending on like who is measuring what. There's not very many, and they're really super small.
Yeah. So our project was seeking out, we did a lot of research into kind of the history of land use and misuse in Scotland, ownership, a lot of deforestation, a lot of politics that has shaped different mistreatments and understandings and approaches to forestry. We spent the first week in the Cairngorms, which is a much more well-trodden, well-known part of the, or it contains fragments of old growth forest. And so we were seeking those out as places that were a bit more culturally connected, I guess, to tourism, to ideas of rewilding or forest, like contemporary forestry, and then much more in the public gaze. The second place where the bulk of the work that we did took place was in the far west North Highlands. Neither Tom nor I can drive, so we had to time our whole trip around the one bus a week that goes there. So we found ourselves waiting at Inverness Station, laden with huge rolls of drawing paper, massive pieces of steel.
So I think like a key early part of the collaboration was getting the materials to the site, which involved some catastrophic leaving of things on trains.
Yes.
But we got there with the stuff.
We did. And somehow we found ourselves in, yeah.
But like in terms of like specific descriptions of the places, like Abernethy Forest in the Cairngorms is, yeah, it's like, I guess it's that picture postcard Scottish landscape. There's like mountains and like mixed woodlands, which have, I guess there is a lot of like conifer plantations, which are like, I guess, residue of 20th century forestry practices. There's also a lot of like what are known as granny pines, which are the like ancient or like old trees that weren't deemed good enough for to be cut down for like timber use. So they're kind of these like lone, sad sort of spectacles, I guess, of like what a forest could look like. And I guess one of the things that I found that we both kind of found interesting, I think, is like looking into these little remnant patches is one of the early kind of environmentalists in the 1950s is writing about the idea that these little patches, and like he draws upon this distinction between a fragment and a remnant. So like a fragment would be like you drop a pot and it splits into bits, and those bits are each recognizable, and theoretically you could fit them all together. And that what's left in Scotland is not that, it's remnants. So it's more like something that's been like chewed up and spat out. And it's like, there's no way to put it back together again. I guess centuries, but particularly 150 years of extraction. So that's Cairngorm site. And then Yeah, the Northwest site was, I guess there's two things. There's the Mountain Ben A, which is the first nature reserve in the UK, first national nature reserve in the UK. And next to that is Loch Maree, which is like this long, thin, freshwater loch that gradually like goes towards the ocean and becomes, there's another loch between that and the ocean, which is a salt loch. And on that, do you want to talk about the, in the loch are these islands, which Kirsty got a little bit obsessed with.
But it's a weird place because we read about this as the first nature reserve. We travelled, you know, we had to time everything to get this one bus a week that would take us into the middle of nowhere. And then we had to walk for like a couple of hours to be able to get along the side of this loch. And so it becomes, this place becomes entrenched with romance and intrigue and sort of one of the wilder places you could try to reach on the British Isles. And then you get there and the areas of forest were pretty few and far between. And you find yourself on this kind of mountain of rock and geology. And yet you've been told this story about this ancient forest that spans the whole of the globe. And all you feel is the absence of forest, which was fairly harrowing. There were also, I mean, the nature reserve itself is, it has its type of beauty, but it was also quite shocking to see how many areas of it were, you know, there weren't trees there and they were actually being fairly recently replanted. And a lot of that has come through varying conflicting ideas of what management of the landscape is and what restoration is, and also what scale of that makes sense. So a lot of these interventions are relatively small, and you on a map that it may look huge when you do a scale comparison between that and inner city London, but when you're in the wilderness suddenly you're very tiny. So we walked along the edge of this loch, and then the sort of pinnacle of the trip, I guess, was to go to the islands in Loch Maree, which we read a lot about and have a lot of cultural mythology and symbolism behind them. Various horrific stories about curing insanity by dragging poor naked people around this island three times and bashing them on the head with some rocks and sticking a bit of metal in a tree. So varying, questionable cultures. But then as we spoke to one of the forest managers in Ben A, then he underlined the reason why we were going to these islands, because in his understanding as well, they are the most untouched remnants of old growth forest that Scotland has. And part of that,
when you say the most untouched remnants, what does that actually, how does that manifest in terms of what someone stepping onto the island sees?
Only one of us can answer that question. Because I didn't know.
There was a kind of a very powerful mythology around these that we experienced as well. So again, part of this project, I think, and part of, I don't know, maybe one a human's experience of the landscape is moving through it. And so in the same way that having to get this bus, you know, to the middle of nowhere along what's called Destitution Road, because it was built in the Scottish famine as a way to keep employment, and each person was paid one bowl of porridge for one pretty grueling day's labor to build this road to be able to get to this forest, to be able to cut down these trees. So even our passage to get there on a bigger scale was incredibly loaded and trod a lot of pretty brutal political and social situations. And then when we got there and we walked to the edge of the loch, then it had its own tests as well. So we managed to get a lift in a camper van to the edge of a huge, this huge bog. And so, and then there are no paths to get down to the island. So we walked through what was, sometimes your foot would land on a rock and sometimes it would go down a meter into what was turned out to be some sort of big, gunge. Wet, gunge. Exactly, gunge is the right word. And so we had to try and navigate this strange, quite acidic, inhospitable land. Sometimes we'd be walking what we felt was towards the islands, because you could see them just over the top of the cliff, and then we'd get to the edge of this rock and realize we were actually on a cliff sort of 15 meters above the rest of the ground, so we'd have to sort of re-navigate. So that in itself was amazing, how just not having paths, which seems so obvious, but you suddenly, I mean, a path is an invitation for a human to occupy a landscape, and suddenly when there isn't that invitation, then cool. So we, over about an hour, we navigated this sort of rough bog land and made it to the edge of the shore, and then the only way to get across to these islands is to swim, which I had to do. So there, I think there was something as well, you've really, really got to want to go there. And there was something quite important about that, that it is out of the human gaze. And it doesn't mean that you can't be part of it, but you've really got to want to. And there was also something in the whole build-up of this to then, I don't know, immerse your body in this freezing cold water. I don't think that lock is tidal, but there's definitely current. and then to finally find yourself, stepping onto this island with this heavy, incredible knowledge that this is one of the most ancient, unspoiled pieces. And so I think it was kind of difficult to have an objective view being loaded with this kind of anticipation. And with the stories of the forest owners and the stories that you've read in books. So it was pretty powerful. I mean, some of the reasons why it's considered untouched is because it's a small island, because when the Forestry Commission representatives sort of drove around the edges of everything with their big map and their big pens deciding the fate of various bits of land, then it was just too difficult and small to be worth the bother. And so that was why it is still forested compared to a lot of the area, which is not. Obviously, it's completely isolated, so it doesn't have the connectivity that it would have done in terms of megafauna or even sort of seed dispersal onto the islands. It's not interacting in the way that it used to. So it's born as a very complex piece of landscape, but its future is getting more and more simplified because it's small and on its own.
I really like this idea, and I think I'm wrong about this, but hear me out. There's this desire to go experience this profoundly ancient landscape, to sort of convey maybe not what it is like, but what it is like to have a body in this place, in this way that it is in a really sort of 21st century way, attempting to understand it outside of the human gaze. And of course, what you're realizing, and I've obviously knew this beforehand, but what you experience is that can't be done. That everything about this is shaped by human hands, that even, like you say, this remaining remnant that that is quote unquote untouched, that your tourist guide would say is like unspoiled or something. Exists the way it does exclusively because of the choices that human beings made. Does that ring true to you? And can you talk a little bit about how that plays into the fact of being a writer as well? Because being an artist who's making, gestural work, and being a writer who's got to translate all of this through language, this, completely cultural artifact, you have to come at it from two different, if interrelated, ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was like an interesting tension, isn't quite the right word, but like, I think there was an interesting difference of approach, I guess, which I think like was quite productive throughout the whole process, which I think was like, I mean, Kirsty had a particular drive to get to these islands, which, I mean, I kind of didn't. But I think in the moment of that experience, well, there were a couple of things. One was like, I mean, exactly as you say, like, for me, the idea of an untouched thing or like pure intact thing is like not real and is a kind of myth, and myth informed what we subsequently have done. And I think like there was an interesting point throughout the whole process where we were, I guess, constantly like curbing our instinct to believe in that myth by going, okay, here are the lines of property ownership around this lot, or like actually it is managed by a national body. So that, and the loch, the surrounding loch is owned by private landowners. So there's this like, so you can see very visibly in the landscape, particularly on one shore where there was like an ironworks and all the forests were cut down to fuel the ironworks and to kill all the wolves, or like remove the habitat of the wolves. And so there's this, there are these complicated histories of like land ownership and extraction and eviction. And that the islands seem like they're kind of immune from that because they're islands, but like, they're not. And obviously like climate change and those kind of like global scale issues prevent the kind of idea of an untouched place. And I think that was like a tension through, or like a negotiated discussion through the whole thing, was like we sort of both wanted to believe this thing and also sort of knowing that you kind of can't. But I think there was a really nice moment, and it was more like, for me, it was more like charting into some like narrative conventions around, particularly, so in advance of going, I had quite a long chat with Camilla Nelson, who I know you've chatted to before. And one of the things I enjoyed about Kirsty swimming across the island and like doing the adventure, and then I was like standing on the shore, like waiting basically. And it felt like a nice inversion of something that Camilla's looked at a lot in her work, but like around like heroic narratives. And normally it's the like male who does the heroic narrative and the female sits at home, like waiting. And I quite enjoyed this like inversion of that, where Kirsty was like off being heroic and I was just standing there going, I wonder when she'll be back. And like, so there was something quite nice there, which I think has then worked through into something that.
I would have been standing on the shore with having dialed 999 with my finger on the send button, essentially.
Okay, so I'll tell you what I was actually thinking, which was like absolute panic. It's like, because like it's not that far of a swim, but like I'm not a strong swimmer, and the water's super cold, so I was just like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, and it was genuinely slightly terrifying. And very like, I'm quite anxious anyway, but it was quite an anxiety inducing experience. Whereas you were like swimming across going, this is amazing, or like, but also like intense and powerful. But I guess that there's that discrepancy between the doing and the watching, or like being nearby when the doing is happening or something. Which is quite interesting. And I think for both of us, it's like relatively powerful, but in totally different ways.
I'm thinking it's probably a bit big scale.
That's okay.
But, it links back to what we were talking about, the relationship between the human body and its impact over the environment, and also its experience of it and its vulnerability of it, and that whole human body and, I don't know, outward land body. And I think there's I'm seeing a lot at the moment about the symbiocene and the sort of repositioning of human understanding of itself and its relationship to the environment as something that moves more towards symbiosis. And I think that idea of symbiosis that I maybe mentioned earlier is really, really important right now and has been really important in this project. The trying to accept the impact of one thing upon the other, that this you cannot get away from the cultural and political shaping of the place you're in. And you can try and convince yourself of the romance of it, but you can never experience it through anything apart from your human body. And you can never experience it through anything apart from the cultural and political and environmental impacts of humanity on it. And that could be seen as bleak, but it's also a truth. And it's a thing that we're all grappling with. And I think that the creative approach that Tom and I were striving towards, for me, is looking towards how do we work in more of a symbiotic way. And so whether that's in the physical actions you're taking on the land, so whether that's as a landscape architect, some of that is what I do, like what is our responsibility and what is in our power to reshape a river, and should we do that and why? We can't just dissolve past actions, we need to acknowledge them and work with them. And when is silence appropriate? I think that we walked a lot, we walked very slowly, we walked in silence, we allowed a lot of space between the writing, between our conversations. Also a lot of the drawings that I made started with loads of stuff on them, loads of ink, and then I left them out overnight and the rain washed the whole thing away. So the landscape kind of enforced an amount of silence. And I think that was quite important. And so I think that the whole set of processes that we were exploring was between our bodies, the world around us, and sort of taking maybe more of a humble position or maybe a kind of listening position and seeing what would come between, for me, the relationship. For example, the relationship between my skin and the island. I went to this island. I became part of this myth. I couldn't make anything there. I couldn't bring anything back. So it was nothing but the story and the memory and the experience. But yeah, kind of seeking for practices in between, practices that involve listening. And I think one phrase that I've been thinking about a lot recently is, what does this landscape want to be? And I think for me, that's a lot of what we were looking to listen to as well. If you can look to listen.
What role does writing play here? And I guess particularly as someone who mostly writes about contemporary art and is mostly like, I don't know, having a critical voice, you're often like framing the way something is received. And there's a certain like power relationship there, where you are overwriting something with like a conceptual framework or a narrative framework, or you're kind of controlling interpretation in a way. And I think like one of the things I was definitely looking at was like histories of writing and relationships of power and what role writing has historically played, for example, in relation to taxation and accounting. And trying to think in this, like what would writing that I make be like that was maybe like passive or disappears in a creative process, rather than writing itself over the top in a like, this is what things mean type of prescriptive way. After having had in Abernethy and the Cairngorms this like difficult collaborative day that was like, there was a sense of like, this felt important for both of us in terms of navigating what we're trying to do together, but like, what have we actually made and is it useful in any sense? Does this go anywhere? And then after that point, we then relocated up to the far north. And I went out for quite a long walk and came back, and Kirsty had like moved all the furniture in the flat, set up like a studio inside the flat, had like paper all out of the floor, and had drawn, started to do the first layers of these like large scale, like transcription drawings. And what was so weird was being able to trace the shape of some of my handwriting in the gestures that she was making and being like, okay, I can see where my writing is in this work, and it's not what I'm saying or what I think I'm saying or anything really meaning related. It's like formal, which was super interesting and like pretty weird. as a writer to experience that's pretty weird. And then there were lots of other little gestures in there that I could see came out of conversations we were having. Yeah, I was just going to say, so I think in terms of that question of symbiosis, like what writing is doing in this process, like those are Kirsty's works, but I can see the collaborative process in there.
So maybe just to explain that a little as well. So the piece that Tom's referring to is called Overwriting, and it was thinking a lot about the legal constitutions, the agreements, the sort of acts that have been passed over time, and how much power they've had in shaping the place, and how each one contradicts the other, or has it enforces, okay, no, we think that the 18th century approach to this is ridiculous, and then the next one comes along and just completely disregards the last one, or the war comes in and a new commission gets passed, and they all sort of conflict and contradict, and they all set out this very strong series of rules, and kind of without much regard for one another, of the one that's coming before, that's came before, the one that will come next, and that it's almost just chatter. It's kind of, it's incredibly powerful, and it's obviously had a humongous impact on the whole landscape of Scotland. So all these, all these sort of legal papers and beliefs and various changing laws have obviously shaped everything that we see today, and most of the things that we can't see today. They've shaped our whole environment, and almost this overwriting, it takes parts of these these scriptures or these kind of laws, and it kind of retraces the writing of them over and over and over and over until they kind of always were illegible, but they become even more illegible. So
I'm just looking at like an image on the screen. So there's like one of the things we were talking about was like boustrophedonic reading, which is like as the ox plows, i.e. along a line, turn around, back, turn around, back. So there's elements, I think, in which some of the line making is like that, right to left, left to right to left, left to right. Then there's like bits that look like forestry tallies, and Kirsty was talking about like this, well, firstly, like the way they arrange forests by quadrants in order to like measure and enact certain forms of like control. There's like a lot of tally making to do with like you were thinking about when they were like, we need to plant 10,000 trees, and like that was done, you know, they would grow the saplings off site, bring them in, like this kind of very specific quantifying. And then there's these like looser marks, which to me anyway, some of them feel like one of the first bits of writing I became aware of in Abernethy was this like, I think, I guess it was like a larval path in a bit of fallen tree that had formed this like, it's like the Greek gamma type shape. And that is a like ink mark on the drawing. And seeing that, I was like, to me, that's imaging that mark. It may not be that mark. But so there's a multiplicity of mark making of human and non-human, I guess translated and transcribed into this big like multi-layered thing.
And it's also kind of thinking about the all of these laws were written often despite of the land. Like you, and even now it's happening. You have to, you know, with carbon offsetting, a lot of swathes of Scotland are being bought, and the wrong tree is being relentlessly planted a million times in a new plantation. And so the sort of disregard of context, then I don't know, the piece as well and the things we were exploring are how deeply political a land is, and what if you removed the biota from it and it was just the authoritarian like text that was left, what would that look like?
The book kind of has like two sections. One is like myth, and the other is memory. It's a kind of loose framework. And the myth is like a kind of little forest story thing that I've written, which is like, which formally has these like long, sort of endless feeling kind of lines that are quite unpunctuated and have a lot of like and hopefully like fall onwards in a kind of a bit like walking lost through a kind of woodland feel. And the form of that writing came from writing these incredibly on these very long sketchbooks. So I kind of wrote that up, and it's based on like two characters that we were just chatting about if we were imagining if we were mythological characters. So that, I mean, it's effectively us, but like mythologized a bit. And yeah, so that was like something that emerged out of the residency, I guess, and like then was worked out more, and then I shared with a few people and shared with Kirsty a lot, and like has been developed accordingly. And then as part of that, as part of it becoming a book, has then like gone back through the, you know, mangle wurzel of Kirsty's creativity. And yeah, I mean, maybe you can talk a bit about how that then looks in printed form.
So again, I guess in the same way that the exhibition is, the pieces are so site-based and the exhibition has decontextualized the pieces and put them in this new space. How does that work? What makes sense here? The book is doing the same. And so in the same way that Tom and I worked very conversationally, that there we kind of tried to get rid of all the boundaries between us and senses of ownership. So he very generously gave me his text, and then I kind of cut it apart and re-put it together in relation with some of the works, some of the ink drawings that I'd done. So the book itself is also an experiment and a kind of challenge of language. So it's not to be read as a kind of traditional story, but it's full of interruptions, pauses, multiple voices. And so it's also exploring how that kind of symbiosis, the cacophony that exists in the forest, can exist in a written and drawn piece.
Traditionally, writing in a conventional sense, your writing goes through a process that is quite limited. I.e. an editor comes along and goes, maybe rephrase the sentence, and then it just appears in a magazine with like very little concern for what it looks like, or what it is. And like having this, then when we went back through it and seeing initially, because I was quite like, this is quite a like raw piece of writing for me and quite like not what I normally write. So I feel quite like protective of it maybe. And then having initially seeing like Kirsty's like, relatively radical interventions and being like, what the fuck is this, if I'm honest, and then like going through it carefully and being like, honestly, it's really quite incredible, like the way that the sense is held and like the text is respected and not like hasn't been pulled apart really, or it hasn't been like anyway, it's been kind of respected, but then the way that like the mark making intervenes and sometimes like supports and reinforces what the text is trying to do. And sometimes like finds things that are there that I didn't know and like brings them to the fore. And sometimes like challenges some of the things that the text is trying to do and like maybe undermines them a little bit. It's pretty cool. And like, I've not experienced that before at all. And like, yeah, that was just like really exciting. And that's come like quite recently.
And then just to end, I guess, so that's the first part of the book. And the second part is a series of photographs of the big ink pieces being made in the forest studio. So they're kind of pieces of the process of creating in this ancient forest.
Thank you for listening to Uncanny Landscapes. We'll be back soon with the next installment. My guests have been artist Kirsty Badenoch and writer Tom Jeffries, discussing their exhibition Falling, Fallen, Felled, which runs this coming weekend, the 9th through 12th of November 2023 at Staffordshire Street Gallery in Peckham, South London. For more on them and to order the artist's book To an Island in a Loch on an Island in a Loch, that accompanies the exhibition, check out their websites, kirstybadenoch.com, tom-jeffries.co.uk, and for the exhibition details, staffordshirest.com. The music in this episode is Unnamed Unseen from the beautiful new album Memory Islands by violinist Ellie Wilson. The album is available through elliewilsonmusic.co.uk. and from the Beagle and Twigetti record label. Music used by permission of the artist.
The title theme is by the Bellbury Poly. The Uncanny Landscapes icon is by Stefan Musgrove. And I'm Justin Hopper. Follow me on Instagram at Old Weird Albion, and subscribe to this podcast's cousin Substack, helpfully also called Uncanny Landscapes. Finally, all the links I've just mentioned are on the Uncanny Landscapes site. That's uncannylandscapes.podbean.com. More installments coming soon. If you've enjoyed this and other episodes, please subscribe to the Substack and like, rate, and share the podcast. Or just tell a like-minded friend.